Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on. Maddie Burevish of the Schlock Pit on here today.
it gets harder and harder to take the website's name seriously each time I hear it. God.
How are you today?
I'm good. Just questioning both my birth name and the fact that I've gave my website such a strange name too. So,
oh, it's a wonderful name. What are you talking about?
You are very kind. Thank you.
Well, I mean, because you're channeling into diving into all the various B movies where you're like, I'm sure I saw that on cable TV years ago.
That's the sort of remit that we go for on the schlockpit.com, where it's generally things that over here in the UK, it used to be a lot of stuff that would be shown on like Channel 5, which is just like sort of a basic network over here. And then things that used to be shown on cable on like Sky Movies or Sci-Fi. Mm-hmm. Bravo, those kind of things.
Totally.
All the good stuff, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. So, I gave Maddie like a huge bunch of franchises because I'm sick of scheduling them and then no one shows up or pulls out last minute. So I was just like, yeah, if we do a franchise, we got to schedule these individually and just decide when we're going to record it. And the main schedule will always be, we just do an episode on a celebrity, you know, an actor, filmmaker, or music band. But mm-hmm. It was like, it's a franchise. We got to pick an actual person who's familiar with it, because I've tried it before where I, you know, got a bunch of people to watch certain ones and they wouldn't make it halfway through it, or they pull out last minute saying that was too much shittiness, and it's like, well, you agreed.
Cowards, absolute cowards they are.
Don't pussy out on me, buddy. I will remember it and not invite you back. So yeah, how did you get into the Lionsgate franchise by Brian Usna and Stuart Gordon that was The Dentist?
When you become a horror fan, you go for the big shit, don't you, to begin with. It's always like a nightmare.
I've heard many talk about it, yeah, but I never knew who was playing it other than when it first came out. It was like played at festivals for investors. It was a big deal because the producer back in that day was Peary David, who was best known for Scanners, Cronenberg features. And I personally knew him because he was a big deal, hot commodity for producing a bunch of home invasion and serial killer movies for Lifetime, but he was mainly just making the rounds around that same time for Wishmaster.
Like in England, The Dentist's always had a certain name value. It was always one of those sort of ubiquitous series that you'd see on video store shelves and stuff. Mm-hmm. It'd always be playing
Corbin Burnson.
Yeah. It would be playing like late night and stuff like that on things like Bravo and Sci-Fi from time to time. And I just always remember being really, really intrigued by
that. That's true. I vaguely recall them playing it. It was very minuscule, but it was here and there. And
yeah, I think guys got them on HBO. I think that's where the first two movies, that's where the two movies premiered for you guys. They were sold to hit as HBO premieres, and then they hit video shortly after.
Exactly. And it's like, and everyone would think, no, they were original movies. It's like, no, it's like, that was a, some of them would even premiere on the movie channels, and that was their marketing tool, because then they were heading to festivals shortly after for a wider release. It's like, so backwards then. Nowadays, festivals, if your movie's already aired somewhere else, you got to keep it on the low. It's like, they want to be the first one to premiere it. And so it's just so wild, the thinking was back then there versus now. And Corbin, you know, he was doing all the major leagues and years before Psych, and just, it's just so funny how he kind of just became in between Mr. B movie and always a reliable actor. You've seen him appear in a bunch of Jim Wynorski's goofy stuff here and there too. It was just always fun, and always a reliable actor, always fun time, always having fun working on whatever.
This is the two movies that turned him on to horror, which is strange. I always remember reading an interview with Brian Usner saying that after Burnson had made The Dentist, that was when he started getting, he wasn't just recognized as Mr. L.A. Law or Mr. Major League. People were shouting, hey, Corbin, The Dentist. There's a great story where apparently Burnson, he was out in New York City and a taxi pulled in front of him the week after The Dentist premiered. And Danny DeVito jumped out of this taxi and just said, hey, Corbin, The Dentist, you were great, and jumped back into the taxi and drove off. I love that.
Back when everyone watched every kind of movie. That's great. That's an excellent story. Oh, my God. It even was just even kind of wackier how just you never just knew what to expect. He was just like always charming one minute and then threatening the next. And just even with his – he's had just so many awesome just guest appearances, Seinfeld, Law and Order, and underseen movies like Counterfeit and the zombie film Dead Air, and just all other sorts of even goofier comedies, and, you know, often co-starring with his wife, Amanda Pays, who everyone knows from Max Headroom. And
he's making faith-based movies now, isn't he? I think that's where what his he went into horror for a while following The Dentist. I think that Dead Air that you mentioned, isn't that one he directed? Yeah, and then he started doing all the Christian kind of stuff.
He did, but fortunately, often just like supporting and way better ones than say garbage like God's Not Dead. He never went that far, but yeah. He's done so many other kinds of things, but it's also been just kind of interesting how he was getting away from Roger Corman around this time and, you know, just going back to just doing TV guest spots and comedy. And I think I just liked how he just kept challenging himself. And, you know, this was years even before he would just always find a way to just stay relevant. He just even appearing in more mainstream stuff, like he's the bad guy in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you know?
So. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was the sort of the big Burnson renaissance, wasn't it? I remember being very excited when that came out. I was obviously being familiar with The Dentist 1 and 2 at that point. Mm-hmm. Being like, oh, hey, there's Corbin Burnson. There's Dr. Finestone. So that was very exciting to see him on the big screen.
Oh, totally. And everyone loves working with him. I've always heard he's just a lovely soul. And just, I was just never he's in a really good In the Heat of the Night episode, but I mean, I was just never surprised to just see him appear in a Western, then do something goofy like Larry Saunders or The Nanny, you know, just, just that kind of guy. And
he was a nightmare on The Dentist by all accounts, a real difficult cat to deal with, you know, but I'm loath to sort of say he went full on method, but there was a great interview he did a couple of years ago in the Dark Side magazine, which is like the horror magazine that we have over here in the UK.
Oh,
and
wow.
They asked him about it, and he said that like him and Usner, they sort of butted heads a little bit throughout the making of both movies, but both of them said it was for the good of the movie, and I do think that that translates on screen. But The problem was that Burnson said something along the lines of, to get into the headspace of Dr. Finestone, where he's got the veins popping in and out of his head and stuff, and that he's that tightly wound and that just crazy and over the top, he couldn't just switch that on and off between takes. And he even said that going home to his wife and his family, he was not a very pleasant person because he was so amped up from the madness of Dr. Fine.
Still. Probably explains why he did just two. He's like, yeah, no, I can't keep doing that. I'm coming home pissing everyone off.
He wanted to make a third one. He wanted to make a third one as well.
I hear they are doing two wrapped.
Well, kind of. Because
it's like a related in theme only. Yeah, like he'll be like a supporting role, but it's, you know, using as involved. So it's like, who are they kidding?
It's a spiritual sequel called The Plastic Surgeon that they've been bandying around since about 2016 time. Burnson, he wanted to do an official Dentist Free, but round about the time they were doing that was what, 2000, 2001. By that time, Usner, he was over in Spain. He was doing all the stuff for the Fantastic Factory, all those movies like Faust, Love of the Damned, and Beyond Reanimator. He was in Barcelona. So they couldn't get their schedules synchronized and stuff. And so it sort of fell away a little bit. And then before they started working on The Plastic Surgeon together, which does need to be made. It's been like 4 years since any updates have been out, and it's killing me. I want to see it happen. But Burnson was actually trying to get the rights to the Dentist, to the Finestone character, but Lionsgate, as we all know, they're very famously tight-fisted when it comes to sub-licensing stuff. They like to keep that death grip on their material themselves.
Well, they for a while, they were kind of the independent. They were acquiring all these popular movies and TV shows, and then they become the indie horror guys, you know, with stuff like Cube. And so, it was their go-to. But I don't know. They might go for it, or they might even just do a total reboot and he'll just do a cameo. But I can understand why he would want to make this, because he clearly just got a lot of people acknowledging him for it. I know he would do conventions and just, I mean, you just see it at everything. It's like, Orban Bergson, L.A. Law, Psych, The Dentist, and, Major League. So it's just like, I think he acknowledges all those four points of his career. You know,
He loves the Dentist Association. He loves talking about it. He's more than happy to talk about it and stuff. But what's always struck me as kind of weird is that he made a TV movie not so long before The Dentist. I think it was called An Appointment for Murder. And it's about the, I can't for the life of me remember the guy's name, but it's about a real life killer who I think he bumped off his wife, and he happened to be a dentist as well. And that was one of the elements that fed into the script for The Dentist. But it's strange that before Corbin Burnson became Dr. Finestone in The Dentist, he was playing this other psychotic gum slasher in another little TV movie.
I mean, look that up. Appointment for Murder. For a Killing.
Appointment for a Killing, or Appointment for Murder. Something one. Like that. Yeah.
All right. 1993. Yeah. St. Louis. Okay, I might have seen this. He even started it with his mother, Jeannie Cooper.
Yeah,
I've seen it. I guess I found it average, but it's a big ass cast, so I'm sure that's 3 years before. So
it's an interesting footnote rather than anything, because obviously the money is The Dentist and The Dentist too, as far as I'm concerned. They are like, because they're the work of, where Appointment for Murder or whatever it's called, that's the work of a TV journeyman. You know, that's a TV schedule slot filler. Whereas The Dentist 1 and 2, their works by, for someone who I thought for a long, long time, Brian Usner, I believe him to be an absolute visionary and an absolute god, especially in the 90s.
I actually got introduced to Voss just one day. That was my introduction to Devoff and Andrew Devoff, the actor. Superb. And it was just fun seeing it on Sci-Fi. I'm like, this is just very...
I love that movie. I love Faust. I think very it's brilliant.
And from that point on, I mean, I instantly respected him. I just saw part of Necromonicon. I am a big fan of Society. And so I was just like, why does this guy not get mentioned as much? Because, I mean, sure, he helped with Reanimator, but that's more Stuart Gordon's playbook. And this is him using leftover ideas with Gordon and a bunch of the other guys and just coming out with something fun. It is also wild how Anthony C. Ferrante just became a well-known makeup guy and then kind of just blew it away just doing crap like Sharknado,
He especially as well, where a lot of his early, a lot of when Ferrante transitioned from, because he was Usner's sort of right hand effects guy for a while. There was always, if you look at Usner's movies, there's always Screaming Mad George, and then
Dennis Smith or whatever, Stan Winston.
And then Anthony Ferrante, he was the one who sort of picked up where, when Screaming Mad George sort of petered out a little bit around mid-90s time and stuff, it was Ferrante who, on The Dentist 2, on Progeny, on using his sort of late 90s American movies before he upsticks.
I'm glad you brought up Progeny, because that definitely felt like that was like a leftover idea. It's like, okay, now this time, instead of that, let's just have a doctor, you know, who does autopsies and everything, you know, just belief that his wife has an alien baby, you know, some shit like that. Mm. So it is kind of wild how they just kind of just went, kept going. All their stuff is, again, just very competent, low budget stuff back when everyone was comfortable doing something for, you know, 10K and mm. to 2 million per picture. And it was just so much fun with these, because these all feel like they could easily be like a, an episode of The Twilight Zone or X-Files even, you know, just, yeah, just with some R-rated content in there. But it was always like, it's kind of wild how they call these like a slasher movie. I don't really think of them as like upfront slasher movie.
No, not at all.
Like, part one is just kind of more of a fun, grossed out comedy, and part two is definitely more of a Tales from the Crypt type episode.
There was, Usner was very... he was very reluctant to take The Dentist initially, because he didn't want it. His nightmare was it was going to become another Dr. Giggles. It was pitched to him by Trimark, which went on to become Lionsgate. And it was, mm-hmm. Because obviously, I don't know if you know the background of the film and stuff like that, but what, Usner had a very good working relationship with Trimark and their boss, Mark Armin.
That
dates back to, Usner initially wanted to direct Warlock the Armageddon, you know, the Anthony Hickox movie.
Yeah.
And so he sort of entered the Trimark fold through their video sales department, because I believe that they had a hand in Bride of Reanimator or something like that somewhere along
the
line.
Yeah, they had some kind of connection to that, or distribution deal. So that makes sense.
And so Usner was lobbying to direct Warlock the Armageddon. That didn't happen, but instead Mark Amin asked him to make Return of the Living Dead 3, which is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the great, if not the greatest zombie film of the 90s. An amazing sequel, amazing film in its own
right. It's as Romero as zombie films got in the 90s.
And that was very, very successful. And Trimark wanted to make more movies with Usner. So Mark Amin came to him with this concept, just a poster and a title, The Dentist.
Nice. Did you get this like from Fangoria magazine, or were these special features? Because I don't think the DVDs here in the States, they were just like
barely. Oh, they're barren. They're barren over here in the UK as well, man. But no, this is from, I have been obsessed with these movies for years. This is years and years of obsessively harvesting information about The Dentist to an almost train spotting anorak type degree. You know what I mean? Like,
no, I get it.
Absolutely. A friend of mine, he actually had the, it's absolutely insane. He wrote a book on Usner, with Usner, the official Usner film-by-film guy.
Oh, sweet.
All interviews with all his key collaborators and stuff like that. But
to this day,
it is sat unfinished. They've never been able to quite finish it and stuff. But so obviously he was able to, he's called Colin McCracken. Absolutely.
Did someone not
guy.
Sign an NDA? Jesus.
And like he's teased us with some information over the years. It's come from old Fangoria articles, interviews with cast and crew, stuff like that.
Internet ones, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like talking to people myself, like for whenever, you know how it is. Like I've got my site, and if I am talking to someone about a film for like, I don't know, a retrospective that I'm wanting to put up or something that I'm doing on one of our own podcasts or whatever, if you find out that they're affiliated with another movie that you adore, you always throw another question in, don't you?
That's
how you learn. You got to throw, if you love them, if you love their work, just keep questioning about all sorts of wacky and weird shit. And one of my kinks, I guess, in that department is if I find out anyone has worked on The Dentist, I need to get information about that movie, just as if I found out anyone has ever worked on Toby Hooper's The Mangler. I'm obsessed with that movie too, and I just need to learn about these films all the time.
It's even funnier when someone is or isn't proud of the work, but they have just hysterical stories, like, I met my best friend, I met my second wife, or I met...
Yeah. Oh, it's nuts. Absolutely. I had one the other day. I dated a scream queen off the back of this movie. How cool is that? How cool is that? So
yeah, what's her name? She was also in Progeny. Very cool actress. Was
Gillian McWhirter, the one from The Dentist too?
I feel like even then unknown Mark Ruffalo, back when he was a B-movie actor about to retire from the business.
Yeah, this was not too long after the Mirror Mirror sequels that he popped up in, and a little film called Blood Money, which was produced, strangely enough, by Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street. So it's crazy that Mark Ruffalo has gone from working with people like
I've heard so Jordan much Belfort. About that.
Yeah.
He kept starring in these movies with Billy Drago, The Untouchables, Canon Films, and it's like, jeez, everyone gets their start somewhere.
Yeah.
It reminds me of those various Children of the Corn shit fest, and it's like how many up and rising actors began there.
Don't be so harsh on the Children of the Corn sequels. There's a lot of good in those Corn sequels. But I would take any Children of the Corn sequel over the first Children of the Corn. Anyone at all.
I mean, whatever works. I like most of the Hellraisers, so what do I know? My poor self. It's all right. This is the fun of B-movies, is that we kind of just, you know, make fun of just ones that can be enjoyed for the best or wrong reasons, and there's other ones where it's like, well, everyone except us trash lovers, we're gonna like this anyway because this is they're just fun, shameless movies.
I mean, I do think The Dentist 1 and 2 are both excellent horror movies in and of themselves. Are they hampered by their budget? Probably, but I think if you get in step,
they look pretty good.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know who shot it,
They were made for buttons, and they were shot on short ends. You know, the first one was shot for absolute peanuts. It was like, you know, I think it was less than $2 million, and The Dentist 2 was even cheaper than that.
Well, there you go. So I'm sure everyone got a bunch of awesome sandwiches, and there were a bunch of other uncredited crew members who basically is like, you're an unpaid intern. Yeah. And it's going to happen, but I've never heard of anything awful happening on the set of, I don't know if you've heard otherwise, but I've never heard of anything awful happening on the set of, you know, Brian Usna's productions.
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all. There seems to be quite a...
I've heard people complain about other B-movie filmmakers who we all like. Again, I'm a fan of Jim Wynorski's commentaries and his goofy-ass stock footage-written movies, but he came from Roger Corman School, so, you know, when he wanted to be a cheapskate and he didn't have to pay anyone, he would do it. He'd get a friend to do shit for free. But he's a pain to just get an interview for because he just demands, like, insane amount of money to where you're like, dude, this is not a convention. I'm sorry I asked, you know? And I've never heard that from Usna. It seems like he was always very down-to-earth. He's very approachable. He's like, just set a time and place and he'll be there, you know? And I've always heard about Corbin, too, just all the various movies he's been on. It's like, in and out. Just knows his lines. I think
that's
he just...
That's what you want with a production like The Dentist. You need someone with... The good thing about Corbin Burns, and he gives the performance, doesn't he? It's like... And because he's such a pro, he's not looking down on the material or anything like that. In lesser hands, you know, you would have someone who gets the script for The Dentist, thinks, well, this is just a schlock fest. But when you have someone like Corbin Burnson who's willing to come in and give it his A game and stuff, it does. I don't want to say it elevates the material, but it because I think the script is very, very good. I think Usna's direction's excellent and stuff. And it's a very well thought out and very nicely conceived movie. But, you know, Corbin Burnson, he is the one who ultimately has to sell you on the fact that this guy is an uptight, obsessive nutcase. And he does so brilliantly, the gusto and the commitment to that part. And then the fact that, yep, he's going to come back again and do it in The Dentist 2. And now he wants to make The Dentist 3. It's wonderful. Wonderful. I do think that he's a working actor who respects the low-budget genre arena. And I think that is something that will always endear a talent to me.
Oh, totally. Because... he'd already earned respect, so it's just like, I can't go any worse from here, and it's just so wild how it became just a cult sensation overnight. It just had the right kind of appeal, and just...
It, It is strange to me, though, where it's weird. Your own impression of movies, you have your own sacred text, don't you? You know, you have the movies that you consider as sacrosanct. And to me, when I was a teenager, The Dentist was always such a big deal because it was everywhere. It was in every video shop. You could buy the sell-through copies of the VHS pretty much in everywhere from a petrol station to your local HMV or Virgin Megastores and stuff like mm-hmm. that. Same when it finally came out on DVD over here and stuff. But then when you start talking to other horror fans about it, you sort of realize, hey, wait a minute, this is kind of a hardcore title, this isn't as well known as I thought it was. And it baffles me because for everyone who loves Reanimator, you'd think that The Dentist would be the next sort of step they'd go to, because you know, you've got Reanimator, From Beyond, and then you've got the same creative team behind The Dentist.
It's very confusing.
Why haven't they latched onto that like they would Reanimate?
It is confusing. You don't know how much of it is just people who knew it back in the day. They recall the nuttiness of it. Maybe it's just that many people really do hate going to the dentist, so this just reminds them. It's like too close to home. Too.
I do think there's a certain. I mean, one thing that me and my sort of creative partner over at the Schlock Pit try and do. We're big into 90s B movies. You know, that's our area. I love 80s B movies. I love noughties direct-to-video stuff, 70s exploitation, all that stuff.
Don't but we all?
These movies from the 90s, it's almost as if horror from the 90s is still considered quite dirty unless it's something like Candyman, The Silence of the Lambs, or Scream. You know, there's still...
There's
occasionally, you'll get the odd sort of breakthrough title, but even then, they're still pretty big. Like something, the last couple of years, a lot of people have really jumped onto Tales from the Crypt Demon Night. But that's still a fairly big studio production from Universal. And it's piggybacking off the back of a beloved cult TV series. Whereas mm-hmm. things like The Dentist, because that went straight to video, it's still a little bit, it's still seen as a little bit grubby and as a little bit naughty maybe. You know, especially as when you look at things that were released at the time by Trimark, where you look at like Stablemates, The Dentist had like Pinocchio's Revenge or like the Leprechaun sequels, the Warlock sequels. They're not exactly beloved movies in the way something like Reanimator was. You know, they're sort of... People take on the Leprechaun series, and yes, they're cult films, but they're seen as a bit of a joke, as a bit of a goof, aren't they?
So, you definitely get that, Phil, yeah.
I think maybe that snobbery sort of still there surrounding something like The Dentist. Like, oh, it's just a shitty direct-to-video horror movie.
You definitely get a bunch of that, because it's just like, I don't know what you're going for, you know? Because... you know, this one, it was straight up. It didn't even need to use any other lowbrow title, you know.
It was exactly what it says on the tin. And what you said there a little earlier on about people being freaked out by The Dentist. I mean, the scenes of dentistry in this film, where he's destroying teeth, where he's busting mouths open with that the metal contraption, where, you know, where he's killing Earl Bone from Terminator. They are really uncomfortable sequences. I mean, even things like the sound design, just the endless whirring of the drill. It's so uncomfortable. But to me, that's good horror. You've rooted it in the everyday, in something that, in a very common phobia, and you are exploiting that, and you are making it a million times more terrifying and worse.
Oh, totally. And I don't feel like it overstays its welcome. I feel like this works in the same way that Sam Raimi and Joe Dante do their kind of thing.
Very well paced. I think that stems down though to the Stuart Gordon, Dennis Paley, and Charles Finch script, which is, and from my understanding, it was I'm not quite sure which one it was who, but one of them between the three of the script writers, they decided to filter it down from like a week as a timeline to a bad 24-hour period in this guy's life. So you watch, so that sort of frantic pace, the fact that the movie takes place over 24 hours, is echoed in the actual pacing of the movie. It just gets in, gets out, does its job, scares you, grosses you out, entertains you. Boom, over.
There you go. Yeah, I don't think anyone has any regrets about making these. I don't think, you know, it could easily go way even more over the top or just to where it just, but I mean, you just know from this point on, you know, just where it's going, how over the top it's going to be, and you pretty much get what you pay for.
I mean, there is a certain sense of, when you have names like Stuart Gordon and Brian Usner attached, there is an expectation there. As you said earlier, Stuart Gordon is synonymous with Reanimator. Brian Usner, among horror circles, you know, he's seen as the squishy, icky body horror guy. He's the midpoint between Frank Henenlotter and David Cronenberg, isn't he? He's somewhere between the jokiness of Henenlotter and the serious, weirdest shit of Cronenberg. And I think that if you see the US poster for The Dentist is from the creators of Reanimator on there, and that would clue you in that, you know, this isn't going to be an evening at the ballet. You know, this is going to be quite a gruesome and icky movie.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I mean, you know exactly what you're stepping into, but I don't know. I will say, I guess the DVD covers kind of leave a lot to be desired.
Usner's been trying to, he's been lobbying Lionsgate to put it as part of the Vestron range, but it's so far it's falling on deaf ears. However, I did notice the other week that they finally putting Candyman, Day of the Dead out on disc, which I always thought that once they do that, they'll probably do the Dentist sequels. They'll probably do The Dentist and The Dentist sequel, sorry. So I'm hoping, because with that whole Vestron range and stuff, yes, you've got some great stuff like Sundown, Vampire in Retreat, Chopping Mall, but they sort of, they're playing fast and loose with like Lionsgate properties. Like I was quite surprised just this month when they re-released Dementia 13. That's not something I would necessarily associate with Lionsgate.
I agree. They went in very unusual areas with it.
Like initially when you had what, Chopping Mall, Blood Diner, even Bud the fucking Chud, that was a Vestron title, I can live with that. But it's, and even things like Steel Dawn, that was a Vestron title, right? That was released by Vestron. But I think I was just convinced that they would be given things like that repeatedly, and we wouldn't necessarily get Dementia 13, or there was another strange one that they, I mean, I loved it. I think Dementia 13 is a great movie, but it doesn't fit the line as well as something like Bob Balaban's Parent or Ken Russell's Lair of the White Worm does. What is the, there's another weird one though that they released, and it's killing, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but there was one Maximum Overdrive, that was it. I thought that's not Vestron, is it? I always thought that was like, I can't think who it was over here in the UK who put that out. It was an offshoot of Universal, because that was a Dino De Laurentiis production, wasn't it?
Yeah, it makes you wonder what deal fell through originally, who owned who. Even when you go on Wikipedia, the information on there is kind of limited.
Yeah, and for a long time, I thought that Lionsgate range, the Vestron range, sorry, I thought it was dead. They didn't release anything for like 2 years. I thought it was dead in the water. And then all of a sudden, it came back, and you had Shivers and Little Monsters.
Because they knew what they were, you know, it was confusing, because, yeah, they were...
They were expensive first as well. They were really expensive. I'm guessing they were expensive in your neck of the woods, but getting them over here in the UK, I was paying about £40 for a bloody disc and get them over. And now you can get them for about 15 quid a pop. And we've even got a couple of them getting released over here by Lionsgate. They've started pumping them out on Blu-ray over here. We haven't got the full ones. We haven't got Chopping Mall. We haven't got all the Wishmaster sequels because they're held by different rights holders over here. But things like Return of the Living Dead 3, Sundown's just about to come out in the next couple of weeks. We're getting them slowly and steadily. usually a few months after you guys get them.
So maybe that's the deal. They're done with international sales and then they're coming back to...
Yeah, yeah. Like, we didn't... We got wax work, but we didn't get wax work too, like you guys did, which was bizarre.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe there's a different rights owner to that sequel. Yeah,
It must be.
Or maybe they were disappointed with the sales initially, so they were putting less effort into it. But see, people have to realize by now is like Blu-ray is definitely any money that you want back, you can get it back through the Blu-ray, because if you pepper it with all these special features and just spend, you know,
A limited edition sort of formula as well works well. You know, when you look at companies like Arrow or 88 Films, when they're putting out like limited edition versions of stuff, that sort of, the very fact that it's only, what, 3,000 copies available or whatever, that's very appealing to collectors. Now, whether they actually watch them or not, that's another matter, because I do
stock stuff,
but a lot of people are just stockpiling discs just for
buy
the sake
and
of
then others. Resell. Yep.
Yeah.
It gets annoying too, because like, I don't know if you've encountered snobs who act like, oh, why do you need it on disc? It's on Netflix. I'm like, not everything's on streaming, guys. And some of us want to see all these special features and commentaries and...
Yeah, I want to learn about the movie.
And different cuts of the movie too, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, it'd be counterproductive for me starting to bash like physical media, considering that one of my sidelines is me and my Schlockpick co-conspirator Dave, we do a lot of stuff for 88 Films, and we started doing a lot of stuff for Arrow in terms of, you know, like commentaries, booklets,
that, oh, lovely. That kind of thing. Congrats. Oh, I saw that you had been doing some stuff on the side, but I didn't know it included
that. Yeah, we've not long done The Mangler for Arrow, which was that was cool. That was a real bucket list for me, recording a commentary for that. It's basically just 100 minutes of me screaming like an absolute fangirl. But yeah, and then we've done Children of the Corn for them, Children of the Corn 2, Children of the Corn 3, and then there's a lot of cool... There's stuff, like, honest to God, I wish I could tell you, but I am sworn to secrecy. The latest slate of like the next 88 Films box set is going to be absolutely killer if you like mid-90s sci-fi horror, and that's all I can say.
That's a lot to go on, actually, but I look forward to it, and feel free to promote it when it does actually hit shelves. Yeah, no, Arrow's doing good stuff. It's a shame that it took them also a while to just kick the whole region thing and just say, hey, you can play our movies anywhere after anything made after, like, 2009 or 2012.
Have you gone 4K yet?
I haven't, because, see, that's just it. It's like, I know, it's like, I mean, I have a few packs that come with a 4K version, but yeah, I don't need to see everyone's nose hairs or unconvincing makeup.
To me, at the minute, I'm still happy with Blu-ray. I'm also very, very aware of I don't want to keep going through the cycle of just buying the same fucking films over and over again.
Yeah, well, it was that was a turnoff, and then there was, it was kind of like with HD DVD, Blu-ray won out. And then so it's like you got all these HD DVDs on a player that, you know, is no longer going to update or continually do that. So it's just like, come on. You know, it's just like, Laserdisc at least had a point. And it's like this, I don't understand the point of this, because it's like it was just a conflict of interest still. And just.
Yeah. And there's part of me as well where surely the more and more, if we keep, you know, remastering these films to such pristine quality, if we get to the point where it's like 16K, at what point does the film itself just become see-through? You know, like, how bright and vibrant do we need?
When will it rupture and you can't match up anything?
You know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend I understand the science of it all. I don't. And most of it is, I just get kind of salty. Oh, great. So I'm going to have to buy The Howling again when...
I mean, I was doing trivia.
And the dentist isn't out yet, you know?
Oh, totally. Well, I think its audience will slowly build up, and who knows, maybe someone can just sign a petition or something, because you know you could get all these actors to do hysterical interviews, maybe do their own Mystery Science Theater, Elvira-type commentary track, you know? Even though the whole thing writes itself, did you see that update on the Silent Night, Deadly Night series, how like they weren't able to remaster parts 3 through 5 because just no one wanted them, so they're always going to be on DVD and part one.
Oh no, I did not know that. I love those sequels.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Part one, they were able to remaster.
Yeah, yeah.
Part two, they struggled initially, so they, an out of print earlier Blu-ray had it to where it's like they had like the updated Blu-ray version of part one used for the flashback scenes, playing over the otherwise 2K scan of part two. So I was like, that's funny.
So what's the scoop with like, because I think
first it was rights holders, and then it was just basically someone fucked up and just misplaced the reels. Because I mean, it was after all just they didn't expect it to be just a growing thing.
Oh wow! I mean, I'd love to see Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, 4, and 5, especially as what 4 and 5 they're using the productions.
I mean, directly. You know, it's made an impact when Svengoolie plays part 5.
That's getting bigger and bigger each year. The toy maker. I've noticed that that's becoming like the sort of maybe the Halloween 3 of the Silent Night, Deadly Night franchise. That's the one that's sort of become the dark horse that people are really champion now. Although I do think it's the user directed 4 initiation, which is the more interesting film.
I think that's a good point. I think Usna's star has always been there and keeps growing at conventions. People want to keep, each generation wants to keep finding out other stuff that someone has worked on. And I mean, we were kind of on a roll for a while. We had access. I mean, me in college, even in the 2000s, I had access to Mega Upload and Rapid Share. And so I was able to put in time for a bunch of stuff when I didn't have physical media, even before streaming. And so then, you know, when those got closed down and then everyone started having a streaming site and then again, endless Blu-ray remasters, then it became a matter of, I think it's just, everyone's just like, hey, I'm going to only spend X amount of time, you know, every payday on media and entertainment and, you know, go from there. And I think some people are still, I think with Amazon's outrageous prices, I think everyone's just, again, just going back to going to random thrift stores, auction sites, and even eBay on a good day.
I'm very skeptical about ordering via Amazon these. They seem to have, I don't know if it's the same for you guys, but the last few things I got, like, did you see that box set Arrow did, the Cold War creature features? I ordered that via Amazon and it arrived, and honest to God, man, it was just absolutely battered to shit. It wasn't even in an envelope. It was just a cellophane wrapper with a label stuck on it. And it was all scuffed and minging. And I was like, well, you know, what the fuck is this? I think the last thing I've got, and that's only because I pre-ordered it months ago.
I've heard about him.
I've got their Phantom of the Mall on pre. I've got Arrow's Phantom of the Mall pre-ordered via Amazon, and I'm expecting it to arrive beaten to within an inch of its life. So
it does seem like there was some shipping and handling issues. It's like, can you not hire someone competent to wrap this shit? You know, will break. Just because it's Blu-ray does not mean it's made out of, you know, metal.
It's not Teflon. What it was for me, the big appeal of Amazon, it was, I love, in concept, I think pre-ordering is fantastic. However, I often do not have the money to pre-order something 6 months in advance. And the good thing about Amazon is they don't take your money off you until it's shipped. So it gives me like a window to sort of...
A lot of those sites were having to learn the hard way. Hey, you know, if you don't want to answer all these angry phone calls, you better stop with that, you know, take the money now and then not deliver. So
yeah,
I think many of the sites learned eventually is like, and Bezos, you know, endless the money bastard. Was no exception. Yep. Total bastard.
Staunch socialist here, man. I can't stand him and what his penis shaped rocket stands for.
Yeah. I pretty much get into who's worse, him or Elon Musk. It just seems like, again, just ego.
Trick question. They're both as vile as each other.
And I keep seeing people get on fan bandwagons. It's like, what does it matter? These fuckers won't give you a single dime, guys, so shut up.
They're rich. They're rich. And again, I get it's kind of strange that we're circling around Usna adjacent topics. You know, the rich feeding off the poor. Like,
yeah, because Usna, I mean, he pretty much just makes fun of all kinds of people. And, you know, here in this, he's making fun of all the rich, spoiled assholes who you kind of don't feel sorry for getting their teeth drilled and shattered apart. And that he comes up with creative ways of just showing how he hides it, you know. And so it kind of, he makes his movies become deeper regardless of how he intended. I think he and Larry Cohen have just been the kind of guys who they've attached themselves to all different kinds of movies, and they've always given it their best shot, regardless of what they feel about it, regardless of where, how involved they were, regardless of how it's been interpreted. Is it a trash classic? Is it actually a good movie? Is it a so bad it's good movie? Or is it a piece of shit that was well intended? You know, it doesn't matter. They give it their all every time. And so, I mean, Silent Night, Deadly Night is definitely an example of a franchise that shouldn't have been a franchise, but it became one anyway. And it kept getting more creative the more infamous it got. So it's just like,
You know, at least with 4 and 5, Usna did something. I can remember I think it was on Dread Central a couple of years ago where
I love that site. Yeah,
and maybe not so much anymore. But back in the day, that was the place to be.
It does do a lot of clickbait now, unfortunately. And it's like, come on, fuckers.
Yeah, I'll save you my full uncensored opinion for another time, for when we're drinking, maybe. But
good. But with, no, with I get what you're going for.
Yeah. With the Silent Night, Deadly Night films, I remember one of the appeal for Usna was that the producer Richard Gladstein was just like, you can do what you want with these movies as long as you set them at Christmas time. So he was like, okay, well, I'm going to get rid of the psychotic Santa. I'll have a vague passing nod to Ricky Caldwell. And then the rest, I'm going to have feminist witches. And then I'm going to have Mickey Rooney as a...
Who had hated the first movie.
Yeah, oh, the irony. But hey, money talks in Hollywood. Money talks.
But then again, doesn't Rooney hate everybody or anything? So, fuck him.
And going on with... In terms of what you were saying about the sort of commentary side of it, whereas obviously in The Dentist, you've got the society-like swipe at Beverly Hills and the sort of the plastic lifestyle up there. You know,
everyone is artificial. Yeah, no one is legit.
Yeah, you're obsessed with neatness. You've got a trophy wife, but guess what? She's fucking the grubby pool boy. And then in The Dentist too, you've got this... You've got the Beverly Hills dentist fleeing into a quiet, sleepy little backwater town that isn't used to his sort of...
He stands out like a sore thumb.
His big, showy lifestyle, you know, and he's trying... And one of the great pleasures of The Dentist, too, is that for lots of the movie, he's trying to blend in, not just because he doesn't want to get caught and incarcerated again. He's trying to blend in because he genuinely doesn't know how to interact with normal people. With the proles.
He's been a sleaze who's hung out with all these other shady characters. And I mean, it was also just kind of fun just seeing some of the other guys. They snuck in there, like Ken Foree as the detective in part one. And with this one, it was more, like you say, it kind of almost was like a reverse backwoods kind of terror movie, except it's just funnier. It's like there's a lot of private eyes and other shady noir kind of looking imitations.
And then the sort of Clint Howard's character in it, Mr. Toothache, when he pops, he's got that sort of 40s noir squealer type quality. You know, the sort of annoying salesman that stumbles across the murder when you're trying to get rid of the body and stuff. He's got that sort of vibe to him.
Camp heaven, yeah. Even just the outrageous skits involving the Nell gun at the end is like, yeah, of course, perfect.
I mean, for a long time, I think I did prefer The Dentist too when I was a teenager because it had more. I love that whole the truth or tooth sequence. Or as when I made my dad watch it, I used to inflict all this shit on my dad when, like, when my mum would be at work and stuff. Me and my dad would be like, oh, let's put something on. So, oh, have you seen The Dentist too, Dad? Let's watch that. And I can just remember asking for his opinion once it finished. I was like, oh, what did you like it? He was like, it was all right. I liked the bit when he was torturing the fat lass. Oh, that was my favourite bit. That was funny. And so I thought that was that's always something that I fondly recall about The Dentist too. My father mocking the poor woman having her teeth destroyed.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. I mean,
you know, sort of going round back to the making of it again, you know that for a long time, The Dentist didn't actually nearly happen because there was a rival production by Toby Hooper at a rival studio, and that sort of put the spooks on Trimark.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the briefs Usener got was, you've got the title, you got it's The Dentist, this is the poster. All the killings and action have to be centered around the chair. We don't want anything sci-fi and stuff. Now, Usener at the time, he'd been developing a sci-fi twist on the film with the writer of Necronomicon and Ticks, Brent Friedman. And that version of the script, when Trimark saw it, they were like, nope, no sci-fi, we don't want it, throw it out. That ended up at Orion just before they went bankrupt. And Orion, they managed to get Toby Hooper interested in it, and that was heading towards cameras with Christopher Lloyd in the psychotic dentist role and stuff. Wow. So instantly, Trimark were just like, no, we're not going to pursue this film at all. Like, no, we can't do that. We will lose money because Christopher Lloyd is a bigger star. So, well, then obviously that film fell apart because Orion lost. When they went bankrupt, they go tits up. So they decide Trimark push ahead with Usener's version. Yeah, and I always think that's very, very cool. But that the Toby Hooper version of The Dentist from the Friedman script, that was a real event in Variety at the time. There was lots of it. For maybe about 2 or 3 months, it was constantly getting mentioned in the Daily Variety, which is just insane. Like, it's crazy to think that these little B-movies were causing a minor furore among industry press and stuff beyond the likes of just Fangoria. And like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like if you didn't get Fangoria, you just didn't know about this. And it's like, that was kind of the go-to thing. And It's cool how you can find some of those classic articles on discounted sales on certain auction sites. It's like, yeah, go for it. If you want an inside scoop, that's the place to go.
Absolutely. Like, and what's cool as well, if you go through the old Fangorias about Usener stuff, guess who writes a lot of them?
C. Ferrante.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Just
continuously just write, you know, so he's doing the effects and then basically serving as the in-house PR unit as well. Fantastic. It's getting harder and harder to get hold of those Fangorias now, but they're going for a real premium in the UK. It's costing a lot of money to get them, and you know, I don't know whether it was naughty or not, but I used to read a lot of them on the Internet Archive. That was like a fucking gold mine on there. They had pretty much every back issue. But then, mysteriously, a couple of months ago, they're all just suddenly taken off. Round about the time Fangoria started heavily promoting their
They probably saw it. I'm sure someone did. And it didn't help that they closed down CineStage, sold it off after all the scandals, finding out that half the people working there were shitty people. So
we're deviants and perverts.
I it sucked because I knew many people who actually worked on those. It's like, oh boy. So it was like every bad job in the world that you don't want, where someone is just, again, just making you feel worthless, overworking you for more than the movie is worth.
So, like, but, so the stories were actually true as well. Like, that is just, that's insane. You know, because there is
no one ever wants a bad scandal to be true. But, you know, it's like, yeah, these people were not lying.
I'm glad they got shut down for that shit. I mean, I'm glad
we've had that it was equivalent of Weinstein. It's like it was falling in the same category as some of these non-union things, and it's just like, Jesus, I thought we did away with all these pricks.
I think there's going to be a lot more of that though as it goes on. I think now it's, we're in a good place where we can talk about things like that now without fear of reprisal, and that's obviously the correct way, because shitty people should be called out, absolutely, and shitty events should be identified. Yeah. I think that as we move on, I think we're going to start getting more and more stories from companies like that and stuff, particularly in the wake of what's happened on the set of Rust. I thought that was like, that someone has got a lot of fucking explaining to do on that movie.
Oh, like, which one?
Rust, the ball, the Alec Baldwin fiasco.
Oh, where, yeah, yeah.
That poor last was bloody shot. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, but, I mean, and that's that is... the other thing. In my experience, just being on as an extra on various sets, that they're, again, people are so, I mean, I've even done music setups for like concerts, and all of them are very toxic environments because people just are so incessant in just wanting, you know, people placed then and there, you know, let the dominoes fall where they will, just get it all figured out, and they just figure, hey, I don't have to like anyone. It's like, well, you kind of do. And like the concert stuff, they would have people pick on each other if they didn't know what they were doing and just talk shit. And it's like, dude,
oh, man, that's not good.
You are going after me. I don't know what to do. And then you'd have even people say, go help that guy. And this is like, this guy doesn't want me. He sent me back to you. Stop playing games. And one day, like, they did not call my name. And then they insisted that they did. And I was like, fine, fuck it. I'm done. It's just like, and because they would do, sometimes they would even do auto pay and not even, you know, some people like to just cover up. It's like, oh, we'll just pay everyone and then we'll figure out by the next time if they actually showed up or not. It's just like, yeah. So I was not surprised to hear about, you know, again, there's this one guy who I knew on Yellowstone who was like an assistant director. It's like, he's doing nothing, but he's kissing so much ass thinking he will level up. And it's like, no, you don't have any skills or creative vision, so you're going to just keep delivering a cupcake to Kevin Costner or Billy Bob Thornton, and that's what you're going to do, you know. And it's like, all these other guys are going to be calling the shots, doing reshoots and everything, and organize. And it's like, sometimes they just get people just because they show up and they can pay them less and no one will ever say anything. But I mean, I'm even seeing with all these COVID restrictions and people not following protocol, is like, I wouldn't be surprised if there's other shutdowns and other just people from SAG do kind of a secret shopper thing and say, you're out, you'll never work here ever again. You know?
I mean, things like that, I'd welcome in the sense of sit. No movie is worth anyone dying on set for. And that, and like, the more details that have come out about Rust, like, each one is more and more jaw dropping than the last. It's
they
like,
knew
what?
This guy sucked, and then they're just like, well, he's just a character. And it's like, you should have seen the writing on the wall, and why are you still using blanks? You know, CGI, fuck's sake. And then there's other people saying, why was he aiming at the cameraman? I'm like, you don't get it. You're pointing it in the position so the camera picks it up, you know, towards the
camera. Yeah. Like, that's basic film grammar, isn't it? It's like, if you need a shot of someone pointing a gun down the lens, fair enough. But the live ammo on set, even blanks on set at that, had such a being used at such close proximity. The whole you know, obviously, oh, it's cold gun or whatever it was that was shouted when it clearly wasn't. The one that's getting me is the apparent rumours of them having target practice with live rounds with the prop gun. I saw yesterday there was a photo released of the prop table where all the guns were placed, and it was like something you'd get.
Yeah, that guy had been like
yard sale, you know.
He had injured Creed from The Office on a movie. He thought it was a bad idea, and he's lucky. He should have just pressed charges on him and said, "Okay, I'm having my insurance company sue you guys." And then it's like, Nick Cage for once had a good sense of judgment and fired him from like one movie, saying this guy doesn't know what he's doing, or I refuse to work on this movie unless you do it a different way. So this guy was just going through the
instance.
Oh yeah. And he was just going through the cracks. It's just, he wasn't being caught yet, even though everyone thought he was a fuck up. So I don't know how he got referred, other than that, I guess he was affordable, but he wasn't good at what he did.
And then,
I guess he just really bullshitted well and everyone bought it. So I don't know.
What's the sort of crack with Alec Baldwin's role, though? Because a few people were saying, well, he was the producer, he did that sign off. But to me,
producer
the impression
just means
I've
he's
got,
creatively
yeah,
involved. That doesn't mean I think, he's the money man.
Yeah, like, I think it was probably based upon the fact it was an ultra low budget movie. He probably got that as like a nominal title with a degree of creative input.
Yeah, he probably added 2,000 extra for extras or somebody. Yeah. I know, you know.
Yeah, and, like I'll take a cut of my paycheck, but I want to be credited as a producer.
Exactly, and that's the key thing. If you want to, I mean,
obviously, I'm just spitballing here.
It's very common. Yeah. On lower budget stuff is like, okay, well, if you want me here, then I got to have a say in developing the character, change some dialogue around. But I mean, here's the other thing too. You're seeing all these tasteless comments because everyone's just used to, you know, we're used to making fun of his sometimes infamous nature off screen, but we otherwise feel like he's a decent guy who's sometimes gone the wrong way. You know, this would be upsetting if it was anybody, whether it was Mel Gibson or Charlie Sheen. It doesn't matter who it was. It's like no one intended to go to set and accidentally kill someone.
Yeah. I mean, I a friend of mine, we were talking about, and he was like, imagine if Twitter existed on the set of The Crow. Can you imagine the shit that would have come out there? Because that was a famously quite a dangerous set by all accounts. The rumors of, you know, at the time in North Carolina where they were shooting, like the crew were powered by cocaine, by all accounts. There was an expose. It was in either Empire magazine or Total Film a couple of years ago. I think it might have been on like the 20th anniversary of the film. And like one of the things that they mentioned is that like the crew were just openly scooping coke and stuff. This is, again, I'm just going off knowledge from that I've gleaned from Empire and Total Film. If anyone who was on the set of A Crow, you know, writes into you and says otherwise, fair enough. But this is what, what they had published, that, you know, that drug use was, and there was an atmosphere of, let's just get this done, let's get this done as quickly as possible.
Oh, totally. So, and it, I mean, people assume that it's just kind of just shows you that is like, regardless of how professional it is, union, non-union, there can always be someone unprofessional up top. But I think we're going to keep getting fleshed out. And this was bound to happen sooner or later. It was bound to be someone who hadn't been found out yet. You know, it's just like when you're taking down crooked cops, it's like the union guys will protect them. And the ones that may have been related to like maybe three other wrongful arrests or something are still out on the street. And eventually they do something else that, you know, an attorney can get them on. And it's the same thing with even other career criminals, you know, robbers or anything. You know, you might have been at the scene of a heist, but you weren't on camera, so you weren't found, you know, and until maybe your third heist or fifth heist, you know, or maybe a decade later when someone else snitched you out. So, I mean, you remember the tale of Midnight Rider, that unfinished movie that had an all-star cast and a camera assistant got run over by a train?
No, oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a couple of years ago.
So many actors were on that, and they were like, screw this. This, you know, director's in jail for life. I'm okay with this movie never coming out. And I would just hear about it, and it's like, that happened on a giant union thing. And someone somehow convinced someone, like, you already... I'm cool with the micro-budget movies and just filming on the fly, regardless of whether you have a permit or not. But I mean, on a train tracks, my God.
Yeah, like what were you thinking? Why are you even doing that?
The minute a train track enters the conversation, that's an instant no.
Yeah. But what I always go back to, and I can remember being in college and learning about this for the first time, and it haunted me, especially like when you see the footage of it, but the Twilight Zone helicopter crash. I cannot to this day watch the Twilight Zone movie. I just find it so upsetting and distressing, just even though that footage isn't in the movie, just it's almost, as particularly in that section of the movie, it's like woven into the fabric of it. It's impossible to separate what happened there from the film. I think that awful helicopter
crash.
Four
great talents, and one of them, I mean, you know, some that I really was not surprised when that filmmaker, you know, Landis got less work, because, you know, stuntmen around use that, even footage of that, as a like PSA, just saying, always call out someone when they don't follow safety measures.
And it's absolutely just horrific.
I've even senseless. Done it on independent stuff. There was always someone who wanted to do a fight scene or a fall, and it's like, okay, but you know, you better plan this out or alter it. And there's always someone who just wants someone to just be up it like all night. They're like, hey, I can do it. So can you. It's like, no, you got to send people home. You got to let them get some sleep so they're not cranky the next day. And, and if there's no safety, then guess what? Yeah. There's not going to be any stunt work.
Yeah, I think that's it is a duty of in any industry, you know. I wouldn't say exclusively to film or anything like that. Shitty people, just call them out. Anyone that makes you feel unsafe, anyone that's got any sort of questionable practices, I think we owe it as
indie film doesn't have to call suck. That
shit out.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be unprofessionally run or with the lowest of the low lives. You know, it's like if someone, I mean, even some of these D-list celebs who keep starring in crap, like, you know, multiple times a year, that gets old to just see how some of them just kind of keep getting work. Cause it's like, well, just cause they're affordable. I mean, does their name even sell anymore? Cause they're in this and everyone knows it's shit. So.
You know, it's another one in that sense that always baffled me is like, is the whole Victor Salva thing. How the fuck did he keep getting work for years? You know, yeah. There is a certain degree of person on Twitter or on Facebook, social media, whatever, who seems to believe that they only started protesting about Victor Salva round about Jeepers Creepers 3, but these protests about him and his work have been going on as far back as Powder back in 1995.
Yeah.
And every time he had a film out, you know, I can remember in Fangoria when they put Jeepers Creepers on the cover, there was uproar. When they put Jeepers Creepers 2 on the cover a couple of years later, there was uproar there. Tony Timpone, he even wrote a fucking editorial defending the decision to do so. When Rose McGowan was in Rosewood Lane that he made, they actually asked her about like what she thought about working with him, and she was just, oh, it's none of my business. It's none of my business. I do have a certain morbid fascination with the fact is how the fuck did he get so much work for so long? Because he's not exactly a bankable director. I mean, you look at his body of work, and really the only sort of financial successes he's had have been Jeepers Creepers. Even critical success, it hasn't exactly been forthcoming, has it? There's always, his films aren't exactly universally acclaimed. Yet he managed to work steadily in the mid-budget $10 million or less arena doesn't sort of exist anymore now. It's either like, you know, massive budget productions or tiny, you know, little peanut productions. But he worked steadily in the same sort of arena as people like John Waters would have done, or like when Brian De Palma was cranking out sort of mid-range thrillers like Snake Eyes and stuff. That was the sort of budgetary bracket that Victor Salva was in for many, many years. And how it baffles me no end how the fuck he continued to keep getting work.
I think it was just at that time, you know, unless someone had seen something, you know, everyone just kind of is like, well, he said, she said. They always did that whole thing. I don't know if he just had a good... I think it was on the records, and yet somehow everyone said, nah, I don't believe he's a, you know, kid fucker. So I don't know. I don't know the extent of the crime.
If you look back over, like... I mean, I thought it was wonderful a couple of years ago when the lad that... now an adult who he molested... Nathan Forrest Winters is his name. He came out and he did a great, great interview. And he just like outlined what happened. And, you know, after all these years of Salva himself trying to just push it aside and be like, oh, I made a mistake when I was a younger man and stuff like that. This Nathan Forrest Winters outlining how horrific the abuse was and how it wasn't just like, because a lot of media were trying to downplay it in the sense that, oh, it was just a one-off incident that happened. But no, he was groomed for years by him and stuff. And I thought it was wonderful that this guy had finally come out and told his side of the story and actually corrected a lot of things. And, you know, and I say that as someone who, you know, I do, for better or worse, I do have a Jeepers Creepers DVD kicking around somewhere. And stuff, which I've had for many, many years, long before I even knew who or what Salva was. But it just baffles me how continually shitty people like that would continue to get work in the film industry.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of was that way with Robert Nepper. He's like, amazing actor. You know, you've seen him on Prison Robert Break.
Oh, there, him from Prison Break. Yeah, and Hard Target 2. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. And I just got just so annoyed how it's just like you hear like these five claims and you don't know if it's true or if, again, there's something to it and he did something messed up years ago. And it's just like, well, either way, this is very upsetting because I like to think he's not who he plays on screen, but I don't know. And but I found just kind of the way it was kind of dismissed was, well, nothing happened on our set, so we think it's bullshit. I'm like, well, you should ask people who are on more than just your set. You know, it's like,
I mean, that's such ridiculous logic. I mean, Hitler was a very good painter by all accounts, but that still doesn't excuse the fucking Holocaust. You know, that's just insane.
Yeah, can you ask the other casting company, you know?
Something? Yeah. Maybe ask the people who he's done it to. Like, you know, but I don't know. I mean, that's a whole separate conversation about whether you can actually separate the art from the artist. I have a very hard time with Klaus Kinski as well. I think Klaus Kinski is a good actor, but he's a despicable piece of shit as a human being.
Well, at this point, it's kind of just become, you know, if it just gets to where you're not even really playing anyone other than your shitty, you know, self, then it's like, we were talking to Charlie Sheen earlier, he's like, he kind of just played himself after a while, and that was the joke. Yeah. It's like, well, that's only funny for so long.
Yeah, that was the entirety of your Two and a Half Men, wasn't it? It's just so, Charlie Sheen being Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, I think you can do it with some talentless and there's others where it's like, sorry, the damage is done, so I just... unless you got someone who just like totally just is that open-minded, it pretty much ends up becoming kind of like, what's the one talent name? I think it can even just end up just getting to even a kind of Roman Polanski level where it's like, hey, love your work. I will never like you as a person.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm pretty comfortable in the choices of what I choose to watch, and I can justify, I think everyone, it's a uniquely personal thing. If say, for example, if you wanted to watch Jeepers Creepers, that's on you. If I wanted to watch Jeepers Creepers, I will watch it, but at the same time, you do need to acknowledge the heinous crimes committed by the
reason it's creepy is because it's made by a creeper.
Yeah, so because Salva is the creeper, you know, the metaphor is there.
It's not
Have you Severin put it out a couple of years ago? I love it. It's called Skinner. Have you ever seen that with Ted Raimi? Skinner?
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
And so the director of that, Ivan Nagy, or Nagy, however you say it, he was actually the boyfriend and rumoured pimp of the Hollywood madam, Heidi Fleiss. Now, you watch Skinner, it's about a guy killing prostitutes. And this prostitute that tries to stop him from killing other prostitutes is called Heidi. And it was made at the time that Nagy, or Nagy, or whatever, however you say his name, was splitting up with Heidi Fleiss just before the big Vice scandal exploded all over Hollywood. You know, when her little black book came out and it was like the names of all executives and actors who were using her call girl ring. And it's just insane that moment in time is reflected within the movie on such a deep level. It's like impossible to separate the art from the artist from that point, because he's woven a character called Heidi in there, and it's about fucking Vice Girls, man. Like, how you can't pull that away, just as with Salva and Clown House, you can't separate them because that entire film is a crime scene. It's extraordinary. How the fuck did we get onto this? This is far too heavy going.
Well, we were talking about, this was like kind of one of the last few indie movies of the 90s that were professionally well made. And we were just mainly just saying, because it seems like nowadays, it's like we see movies that are just as bad as the cover, like even worse than the cover, or just, again, just no one tries anymore. Like, I've seen a few people who I know in this area who are working on something, and I'm like, yeah, no, that not only doesn't even look like a movie or anything, you know, I hate how everyone does a lot of stuff that's like intentionally bad. And then there's just like other stuff.
There's nothing worse than irony. What you said, like Sharknado earlier on when we were on about Ferrante, like that is just, if it, to design a deliberately, oh, isn't this movie so bad it's funny, that is really offensive to me. Whereas when you look at something like, it annoys me when people say that The Dentist or The Dentist 2 are so bad they're good. They're not. They're just, to me, they're just good movies. They're low budget, yes, but they're
low brow, but they know it.
They're designed, you know, there's an internal logic to them. You can see that there's a vision on screen.
Exactly. Like totally.
You might, yeah, but you might, for legal reasons, you probably have to cut all the Salva shite out.
Oh, it's fine. Everyone knows he sucks. So, I mean, I think we're good. I know what you mean. It is like, well, and that's a good point too, because it does seem like some criticism can come off as a rant, and you don't know half the time, like, who's being legit, who's doing that just to sell a paper, who actually believes in the cause. So that can get old too. It's just like, you always got to give that disclaimer, you know, this is an editorial or this is an actual news reporting, and then we spun our narrative on it, you know. Complicated nowadays, huh?
Yeah, and I think I'm hoping that things get better. Like, I like to think that we live in a progressive society and that we are all maybe being a little, you know, I'd like to give people the benefit of the doubt that we're going to be kind to each other and shit. But then you turn on the news and like that fucking shit that you guys have to deal with the fucking takeover of the capital by all them fucking Proud Boys and whoever the fuck they were. That was just, wow. Wow. That was extraordinary watching that. I cannot begin to imagine what the climate would have been like over in your place, having to like live through that.
We felt like we were a third world country all of a sudden. It was just like, wait, what?
Just insanity. Absolutely insane.
It was like the worst Die Hard movie ever I saw. It was just like, Jesus, you know, that we should not be having, you know, and then people were trying to lessen it. Oh, they weren't successful. I'm like, you don't get it. This represents what a lot of people are feeling like. It used to be you would be a freedom fighter and you would do, you know, a takeover or something, and you send a message. It's like, but this message was, you know, anyone we don't like, we're gonna hang, and we don't think we can legit win, so we're gonna just kill anyone who, just so this guy can remain in power. So it's like, so you are a dictatorship.
No, we're not actively destroying democracy. Extraordinary. And he's still going on about it now, isn't he? Every now and again, there'll be something pop up on like BBC News and stuff where he's made like a ridiculous comment about wanting like a recount still and stuff. It's like, just admit you lost, fucking orange face.
And the name of the law firm is Cyber Ninjas. So I'm like, I already don't take you seriously. They even had multiple time, but then they realized they came up short. And which was their way of saying, we don't actually have any actual substantial evidence, so we just are going to stall because we don't even respect the rule of law in any way. So it's like, why? So in other words, you could a judge could overturn this and you still wouldn't respect it just because it's just like with choosing who you want to argue with. It's like, I will have a debate with someone who I know has some sort of intelligence. If I know you're already a dipshit, I'm not going to even waste an hour on you because
You can't argue with stupidity. You can't reason with stupidity. They come into it with their mind like...
You can even remind them that they're stupid, but it's like, they can't get it. So, yeah. It's like, oh, boy. But fortunately, I think these kinds of movies that we're talking about on this podcast, we even kind of just give even a disclaimer saying, it's like, hey, we want to talk about this because it's kind of underappreciated or not talked about enough. And it does seem like there's a lot of people who kind of want to forget that certain movies are in their vault, that like they aren't offered for like even a digital rental or anymore or anything. And it's like, were you just disappointed with the sales? Did not enough people buy or rent it or know about it?
The Dentist occasionally pops up on Amazon Prime over here in the UK.
I bet.
Not for streaming though. You have to rent it. It's always like $2.99 or $3.99 or whatever, but it is on there. You can rent it. I'm surprised someone hasn't curated it for the likes of Shudder or anything like that. But again, that probably
That's surprising, yeah.
Yeah. It probably goes more with Lionsgate Death Grip on the rights to it and stuff than anything, because I'm not quite entirely sure if they've bought into the streaming game yet or if they're even interested in that.
Well, no, that's a good point, because it did seem like a while, for a while, they would you know, rights would change for every other movie or show, and you didn't know how much of it was just legit versus, again, you know, like, it was kind of even just goes back to anytime anything is stolen, people are like, no, take it down. It's like you're going to do anything with it or make money off it. You know, it's just like, what are you talking about? Are you kidding? This is like, it really is amazing how it kind of even reminds me of, you know, when Trent Reznor, you know, said fuck you to Universal, and he's like, yeah, go ahead and steal my music, because he was hating the deal they were doing and everything. So I think we still have some of that rebelliousness out there where there's someone who's just like, yeah, well, I get how unfair the industry is now, so yeah, I'm fine with you stealing it. Just anything that sends a message to the higher ups that they need to, I mean, you've seen the messed up stuff with Activision continually sinking, you know, to the bottom of the barrel just with their off-color comments disrespecting gamers. And don't get me wrong, gamers can be a total handful most of the time, but you know, I also don't believe in instigating, you know.
yeah don't be encouraging
the gods of Egypt deal where regardless of how politically correct a movie is, don't also act like, oh well, there's a problem but we don't want to address it, so fuck you, come watch the movie. I'm like, well, did you even hear yourself?
I mean, Lionsgate must be pretty shit hot with piracy, though, because every time something like The Dentist or even like The Leprechauns or something pop up on YouTube,
yeah, they don't care.
It's pulled down. It is pulled down, like, and then it's quickly back up available to rent via there. So they must have a. Like an interest in the property still, in the sense that they know they can make money off it to some degree. I just don't think they probably figured out how yet.
They've been around for a while and they've always kind of just managed to, I've embraced a lot of their movies because they were able to kind of embrace every kind of area, whether it was home video market, theater market. Just always had a bunch of extra stuff lying around and they kind of knew how to just, go about it, so to speak. They, because I mean, I can't think of any movie that really didn't play, you know, less than a few weeks anywhere, except for like the second Punisher and maybe, I guess, Strangeland. They pretty much had it all figured out. It was like, yeah.
It's weird that they still, because obviously Trimark began as Vidmark, a video company.
Then there was Live/Artisan, yeah.
And then like Trimark were very, they were open to direct to video for a long time, as The Dentist like illustrates and stuff. But then as they transitioned to Lionsgate and, dare I say, became a little bit more quote unquote prestige, they sort of forgot their roots, and that's when direct to video became a bit of a dirty thing for them again, I suppose.
Yeah, it's kind of, I equate the current movie market kind of like the stock market, where it's like, it's fine until you oversaturate, then you got to start all over again and embrace different kinds of markets. Well, thank you ever so much for being on here. I think this is a very eye-opening experience as to why this kind of hit the mark in the horror comedy venue. So I know who will be there if, you know, there's a Q&A exclusive sit down.
Well, I'll be there first in line when they do a sparkly 30th anniversary release. The First Dentist just had its 25th anniversary over here in the UK. It premiered on video here in the UK on the 1st of November, so 1996.
It is interesting how certain movies is like, you know, came straight to video in the States or UK versus theaters, you know, and it is kind of interesting. I mean, I've said this about other stars who kind of had that same kind of predicament where they didn't, you know, actors are not the same, you know, and their agents can't always predict what the distributor will do with their work. So it is interesting seeing how the 90s and early 2000s just flourished with this, you know, alternative, and then it kind of got a little extra picky when people started abusing all the formulas, you know. People started buying more theaters to play their things in. There's been a lot of stuff. I mean, Now we do the whole video on demand same day as a theater. And it's like, that was a foreign concept that was only being tried out with certain stuff, often with, you know, After Dark films and Magnolia around 06, 07. And then it just became just like commonplace after that. And now almost everyone's doing it post pandemic.
Didn't Steven Soderbergh pioneer one? I'm sure one of his movies was like date and date release.
Yeah. His movies have always not made enough money, but always gotten acclaim. So yeah, it's another example there too, where it's like everyone wants to work with you, but don't expect an instant return for all your investors. I think people have had to be reminded of being patient. I think it's also, like you say, it's a matter of, you know, whatever the first impression is, if it's positive, we want to keep working with you. I mean, there's plenty of actors who technically should have already, years ago, would have been out of work for a while, would have probably gotten different gigs. But now, because they can say, hey, I'm an award winner on every poster, you know, someone keeps investing in them.
True, man. True.
So wild. And we can only hope for a better system, because, you know, I don't want a piece of shit made in Oklahoma to keep making the rounds on Amazon Prime. I do want, and I also don't want very cheap Netflix movies. I don't want any of that to keep happening. I do hope people can keep kind of coming up with better web series and independent productions, instead of just having too much free time with their camcorder or iPhone and just saying, hey, that's the movie.
I don't know. That makes me nostalgic for the days of J.R. Buckwalter and temp video and stuff. That's just the new temp.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, those guys at least used it better. They used it just like a reel of filmers. Like, I only got X amount of videotape left before it crashes. So, anyway, you rocked this, and can't wait to upload this episode.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of...
They must be destroyed on sight!
As needed, and let the hosts, Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin puff, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema PsyOps is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in you.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. Oh, I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that.
Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of.
It's unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist.
Watching this film again, I had all of this like little nerd glee with everything that kept
little history
up.
Doll yeah, popping up
absolutely.
At you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you know, couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was.
How
be
did
a rough
you watch
one.
This shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema PsyOps.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey
and I'm Zach. And we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 out. Bana 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 out.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-liner plot holes, a gratuitous movies. It's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy
at EILFM.podbean.com.
Welcome to Who Was She Podcast. I am your host, Tara Jabari. After a decade working in documentaries, marketing, and all things digital media, I found that podcasting is a strong medium to share stories. After years of producing for others, I decided to start my own biographical podcast. Who Was She will focus on the life of a woman throughout Baha'i history. The first season is about Lydia Zemanoff. Lydia's story explores the subjects of the power of language and faith. Her father invented the universal language Esperanto, and she came from a Jewish family and became a Baha'i. She grew up during World War I and was killed during World War II in a concentration camp, despite heroic efforts to save her life. How can one person's life intersect with so many others, connect across borders, and inspire a biography, which inspired this podcast? Over the next few weeks, I will share her story with you and the lives that were most affected by her and those who affected her life as well. They include her father, Ludwig Zemanoff, her spiritual mother, American journalist Martha Root, and the Baha'i German soldier Fritz Mako, who worked for the resistance undercover while having to serve the Nazi party. I want to thank the author Wendy Heller and George Ronald Publishing for their blessing to let me use Heller's biography, Lydia, The Life of Lydia Zemanoff, Daughter of Esperanto, as a main and instrumental resource for this podcast. So please subscribe and learn about this amazing woman who traveled through three continents in an effort to bring unity through the power of language. You can also find more information on our Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest at Who Was She Podcast. Music was composed and performed by Sam Red. I am your host, Tara Jabari. Join us next time as we begin our journey about Lydia Zemanoff.
Are you sick of the same old stale podcasts? Well, then join Vanessa and Darren as they dissect movies of all kinds. The two lifelong cinema lovers bring their favorites, curiosities, and first-time watches to the operating table and inject them with a healthy dose of snark. Then there's the waiting room, where they examine books and short stories. So just look for them on Apple Podcasts and where fine podcasts are available. They're part of the Legion Podcast Network. Follow them on Twitter at VD Clinic Pod. Join them on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/VD Clinic Pod. Or email them at vdclinicpod@gmail.com. They're ready to cure what ails you. And still, they just might be a little contagious.
Hi there. It's Heather from the Watching Netflix Without You podcast. Did you know that there are over 1,200 Netflix original feature films and documentaries? And that number is only growing. So I've made it my mission to watch as many as I possibly can. Then, with a delightful guest or guests, disclaimer, more often than not my brother Ryan, we spend an episode rating, reviewing, and discussing a film at length. The first half of every episode is spoiler-free for those who haven't seen it yet, and in the second half, after a very clear spoiler warning, we dive into it. And that's really about it. You can listen to Watching Netflix Without You on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.